group for the sins and errors of Comrade X or Comrade Y. Not at all. You see, in order to understand what has happened in big scale politics, it is necessary to see what happened to the communist movement, and some aspects of it anyway, and how revolutionary socialism was effectively marginalised. Right? The downward slide. Not a very encouraging story. The encouraging story comes afterwards, you see, when we come to the climb up again. But nevertheless, it is of fundamental importance. And I start with 1929. I'm going to talk about 10 years altogether. 1929, Trotsky was exiled from the USSR. Two other events of fundamental importance occur. One, the great crash, the onset of, in the States first of all, the biggest depression in the history of capitalism so far. Massive increase in unemployment in all the developed capitalist countries, and moreover, a slump that lasted, little oscillations of it, which was to last for the greater part of a decade. That's one thing. And which, of course, transformed politics in all the developed capitalist countries, led, in the case of Europe, to the victory of fascism in the great majority of European countries and the destruction of the working class movement. Another thing, also in 1929, Stalin and Kohl were, of course, in power in the USSR. Before that, they put their decisive victory in 1927. But in 1929 occurred the liquidation of the kulaks, the forced collectivization of agriculture, the crash program of industrialization was got underway. In other words, a chain of events was started which proved quite irreversible in the period of some decades, and which completely transformed the nature of the USSR also. Not only fascism, but also Stalinism, in the sense that we came to understand it, also can be dated. The onset can be dated from that year. Now then, we are not therefore talking, when we talk about the ideas involved here, about insignificant events or groups of people who were out of this world or anything like that. We're talking about what actually happened on a big scale, which determined, to a very large extent, the whole shape of politics for a long, long time to come. Now, what did the Trotskyists amount to in 1929? Forget about Russia for the moment, right? When Trotsky came outside Russia, they amounted to nothing, except Trotsky and a few individuals. What did they stand for? Well, now, essentially, three things. One, the argument that inside the USSR there has been a bureaucratic reaction. Not a counter-revolution, but a bureaucratic reaction. And the existing regime, what had come into existence, is highly unstable and must, in no great period of time, either collapse into restored monopoly capitalism, like that of the West, or, alternatively, the working class could regain power. Right? But essentially, this is a fairly limited time scale. Secondly, very important, the question, more important in an operative sense, the idea that, look here, the potential for reversing the whole unfavourable development exists. Revolutionary potential exists in the West. In particular, the big communist parties in Europe can be brought back to revolutionary positions. Opportunities for the seizure of power will arise. The European Revolution, therefore, is a realistic perspective under certain circumstances. And revolution, major European countries will transform the whole world situation. Third, that in order that these things should be done, it is essential to shift the policies, to shift the direction of the existing communist parties. Now, I will call that Trotskyism in its reformist stage. Please do not misunderstand me. I'm not talking about reform with respect to capitalism, you know, reform or revolution, but reform with respect to the existing communist movement, which existed as a mass movement. Okay? Reform also in the USSR, because Trotsky argued that by and large it will be possible, the USSR is still fundamentally a workers' state, it will be possible, without the actual destruction of the state machine, right, by a reformist process, radical reformist process, if you like, to restore a healthy workers' state. Okay? Let us look briefly at what happens in this. In particular, let us look what happened in Germany. I take Germany, we can't cover the whole world, because as a matter of fact, it was, at that time, the most important country in Europe, second largest industrial power in the world at the time, of course, but the most important country in Europe for quite a different reason. As the slump developed, it hit Germany harder than anywhere else except the United States. Mass unemployment developed. The whole basis of Weimar social democracy was rapidly undermined. The fascists, comparatively insignificant, in 1928, they got a vote, as Sparks points out in his little book on the subject, they got a vote in elections almost exactly the same as the National Front gets in Britain today, right? By 1932, they were on the verge of taking power. The mass development of a real fascist movement in Germany. Same sort of thing was happening in other countries. Let us concentrate on Germany. Now, these circumstances, all the greater part of Trotsky's effort was directed to the idea that, look, first of all, you've got to convince the Communist Party leadership. You've got to convince them, you use the pressure of their members if you can, that they do face a deadly threat. That Hitler is not a joke. That there is a real and profound difference between fascism and social democracy or ordinary conservative governments and so on. All this was denied. So let's see why. Let's see what was happening to the communist leadership. You see, they had pursued, under the influence of the Comintern in the middle 20s, what we would now call fairly right-wing policies. Now, qualification. Right-wing in communist terms, not British Road to Socialism type politics, of course. They still theoretically stood for the proletarian revolution, the dictatorship of the proletariat, and so on and so forth. But in practice, their policies were fairly rightist, oriented on the social democrats in varying ways and other forces. We haven't time to discuss that. The important thing is that in 1928, and still more in 1929, there was a violent turn in all the communist parties. Now, 1929 marks, you know, the decisive victory of Stalinism in Russia, but also effectively the complete Stalinization of the Communist International. You know the saying they had, when Joe turns Stalin, that is, we all turn, virtually unanimously. This really dates from this period. And they were wrenched from a fairly rightist position to a position which, on the face of it, was wildly ultra-left. On the face of it. In particular, the theory was developed that, look, what has happened in Europe since the war is as follows. First of all, we have the first period, the period of ascending revolutionary struggles from 1917 to about 1923. Then we have the period of stabilization, the second period, the temporary re-stabilization of capitalism, which lasted from 1923 until the 6th Congress of the Comintern, the end of 1928. Right? Now we are in the third period, quote, the period of ascending revolutionary struggles. Now, let's see what's behind the rhetoric. What is behind the rhetoric? You see, they actually start with the conclusion and work backwards. I'll work forward from the rhetoric and pursue the logic. In circumstances where the working class movement is on the defensive, the United Front tactic, the attempt to draw significant numbers of reformist workers into struggles on a less than revolutionary basis, is a necessary thing for communists. That, someone else should have been discussed earlier on, right? But of course, in an actual revolutionary crisis, you can't talk about the United Front. You see, the United Front is not a universal recipe for all circumstances and all times. Very obviously, in an actual revolutionary situation, the social democratic leaderships and those they can influence will play a directly counter-revolutionary role. After all, isn't that exactly what happened in 1918? That's how the Weimar Republic was established in the first instance. This is ABC, isn't it, comrades? And therefore, conclusion, they are now the principal prop of capitalism. There is no real difference between social democrats and fascists in this respect. And because there is no real difference in this respect, there can be no question of the United Front in reality, I'll leave aside their fairly meaningless qualifications they made. The point is, the main enemy is the Social Democrats, and indeed it was discovered on the basis of some exceedingly flimsy and spurious argumentation by one or two people which Stalin adopted, that actually the Social Democrats are themselves a sort of fascist. They were christened social fascists, you see. And since they're actually in power in Germany, that's an oversimplification. They're a coalition government, so far as we desire. The government of Prussia, the biggest of the states, because they're actually in power, in a certain sense fascism is already in power. And consequently, you see, the whole weight of communist agitation has to be directed against the Social Democrats. And it wasn't simply that. It wasn't simply that. The tactic was pursued to what you might say on the face of it, quite a lunatic extreme. It was applied to the trade union. You see, who? And again, I'm sticking to the German case, but the argument was generalised. Who runs the unions? Social Democrats. What are they? Social fascists. What are the unions, therefore? They are simply instruments for the perpetuation of capitalist class rule. Period. Right? Period. There's always an element of that. There wasn't any trade union organisation. But that's it. Therefore, what do we have to do? We have to create other unions, which are pure, revolutionary, red unions. They don't have to be consist exclusively of communists. Oh, no. We're quite willing to accept non-communists into membership on one condition, that they accept and advance the leadership of the Communist Party. Right? In other words, a tactic was pursued, and if I had time, I could produce some fairly hair-raising material on this. A tactic was pursued in which the whole weight of the CP's agitation was directed against the Social Democrats in such a way as to guarantee, practically, that the ranks of the Social Democratic Party, their millions of supporters, were in effect pushed behind their leaders. And this was done, and this is the point, under conditions of accelerating crisis, not simply economic crisis, but political, social crisis, which very obviously could not be resolved within the framework of the Weimar Republic. And consequently, you know, decisive changes at hand, the main threat being Hitler, the whole emphasis and weight of the Communist Party's activity was such as to facilitate his coming to power. Now, I have presented the argument as Trotsky presented it, and he was essentially correct. He dealt with the matter in enormous detail. The whole point was, he believed that, you know, it is incredible that they can be so stupid as not to see this. They are stupid, he said, you know, there's not a number of course to decide on this sort of thing. But nevertheless, since their necks are at stake, kept arguing, you know, if fascism comes to power, it will smash the entire workers' movement, reformist and revolutionary alike. It will set back, you know, the whole European development for years or decades, a very accurate prediction. In these circumstances, the weight of argument, he thought, combined with the activities of the Trotskyists, we know that it didn't happen. That in reality, paralysed by, on the one hand, the vacillating policy of the Social Democrats, but we take that for granted, on the other hand, the fact that the Communist parties, under Stalin's influence, pursued policies which made an effective fight back the winning of the mass of the social democratic workers to the united front against fascism virtually impossible. These circumstances produced Hitler's victory. Now, Trotsky was not alone, but almost alone, in recognizing that at the beginning of 1933, which is when Hitler came to power, the world had changed fundamentally, right? But this is no mere change of government. The whole course of historical development had been wrenched out of one general direction into another. And he therefore came to the conclusion that the Communist International, the Communist parties, which he had up to then said, you know, bad as they are our parties, there is no other hope, you have to reform them, you have to change their policies. He said, look, this is their 4th of August, the reference, you know, to the capitulation of the breakup of the Second International, beginning of the First World War. This is their 4th of August. As a revolutionary organisation, the Comintern is finished. It is necessary to start again. Now, I've spent considerable time on that, perhaps rather too much time, because I now want to invite you to consider some of the implications of that position in connection with perspective for revolution, revolutionary politics in Europe. You see, all people in the communist tradition have been arguing very vigorously ever since the Russian Revolution, without a mass revolutionary workers' party, you can have a revolution, yes, but you cannot have, you can have the overthrow, a revolution in the sense of the overthrow of a previous regime, like the overthrow of the Shah, but you cannot have the conquest of power by the working class. For the conquest of power by the working class, a revolutionary workers' party, an authentic communist party, which is a mass organisation, is a necessary condition. And then, we say, write it all off. We have to write it off. And there's no question about it. There's something that you then show. Trotsky was entirely right about the revolutionary potential of the communist parties. It had gone. It had gone. But the implications of that are frightening, terrifying. And in order to understand, if you like, the tragedy of the subsequent development of Trotskyism, not just before the war, but for a long time, you have to grasp this staggering fact. Now remember, Trotsky himself said a few years later, when asked to explain why things were all going to hell and so on and so forth, he said, look, you know, the same generation that saw the collapse of the Second International, then saw the Russian Revolution, Communist International, and so on, all the blunders and what have you, but nevertheless, the International, now this same generation, we're saying to, it's all finished, you've got to start again. You know, and as he said, but they say, we've already heard that once before, you know? That is to say, with respect to the Social Democrats. In other words, the impact of Hitler's victory was such as to create conditions in which the revival of the revolutionary movements in Europe was made, if not impossible, immensely difficult. The odds then were loaded and loaded and loaded. We can now trace the subsequent course of developments rather quickly. Of course, Hitler's victory was not an isolated thing. There were fascist movements in the rest of Europe. The very next year, 1934, the Austrian Social Democratic Party, which was totally dominant in the Austrian working class, the CP was marginal. It wasn't like Germany, where there was a big CP and a big Social Democratic Party. And this party was reputedly left, avowedly Marxist on paper and all the rest of it, and so on, was smashed. Not indeed in this case without resistance, as had been the case in Germany, with the resistance that was too late, too badly organised, and in any case on such a defensive perspective that had no chance of success. The fascists came to power in Austria. They were already in power in Italy, remember. In Spain, 1934 again, the Asturian Rising was destroyed. We don't have time to go into the details. And an ultra-reactionary government, which people, most people thought was actually fascist, it wasn't in reality, it was a very right-wing conservative government, came to power, the two black years. The actual fascist movement was, of course, meanwhile preparing. In France, it appeared, in 1934, that there was a serious attempt by the fascists to seize power in Paris. I mean, to seize state power. Now, in reality, we can see in retrospect that not all these things were quite what they seemed to be. Nevertheless, you had this, and important to think in terms of people's consciousness, this rising tide of fascism everywhere. Even in England, in Britain, Bolshevik started out a fascist movement which in the first year or two looked as though it had the potential to become a mass force, and so on and so forth. This produced an effect. It produced a profound effect, even on the most bureaucratized workers' organizations in reality. Because the Comintern and the Communist parties were by this time totally Stalinist. Now, I keep saying this, and I'm acutely aware that many of the comrades here have never actually seen a Stalinist party. They've only seen the British Communist Party in its de-Stalinized period. You know, that it's been de-Stalinized for a long time. Stalinist parties, total unanimity, right? Not a word of dissent. Not a qualification or what have you. The fantastic worship of the leader, the big leader in Moscow, you know, his picture is everywhere, but also the little one, the little Stalin. In Britain he was called Harry Pollitt, and we have to hear him talk about it. I'm quite serious, in Germany, Tories and so on, they were built up, the pictures and so on, in this way. Even in these parties, as a matter of fact, and particularly the big ones, the French particularly, the victory of Hitler and the subsequent events produced a wavering, a fundamental wavering, which we know now, although Trotsky did not know it at the time, actually affected even the Moscow centre.
Secondly, the social democratic parties left currents developed. It is incredible, but nevertheless, even in the British Labour Party, left currents developed, and we did have authentic social democrats talking about revolution. I quoted one of them, that was last night, wasn't it? Athletes, you know, athletes, and so on. These currents became significant. Now, I've said, one, without mass revolutionary parties, no perspective, right? Two, Trotsky's conclusion, correct essentially, 33, the communist parties are no longer revolutionary parties, they've ceased to be such, therefore you have to start again. The emphasis then is on where do you get the new forces? And we can see this pursued by two means, and then eventually, finally, aborted. First means. There were various breakaways from some social democratic parties. There's one in Britain, it was called the Independent Labour Party. It doesn't matter, it broke away from the Labour Party to the left. Not a very big organisation, but a few thousand. And since there were at that time, in 1932, precisely 13 Trotskyists in Britain, 13, that's the figure, a few thousand is not to be despised, is it? Therefore, you must, the argument was, relate to these people, not because a few thousand is enough, but because with a few thousand you can create a force which ultimately you can, and when I say ultimately, we're talking about conditions of crisis, this is the 30s, right? It will be possible perhaps to create a bigger force and so on and so forth. In France, similar sorts of developments in various other things. We haven't time to go into the details of this. We merely say that these leftward moving social democratic groups, left social democrats or centrists, Trotsky called them at the time, he made an attempt to weld them together. To set up, not indeed a new international, because he recognised at that time that you can't talk of an international without serious forces and so on, but at any rate it's a force to attempt to create one. And to create, you know, the nucleus of a new communist movement. We can deal with that briefly. The height of this operation was 1934, when it was possible to get in Paris a conference of this rather assorted and variegated lot. I mean, we would have been there at the time, you know, in the circumstances. So would Peter Hain and his lot. You know, I mean, it gives you a fair idea of the spectrum of opinion within the thing. The attempt to create the nucleus of a new movement out of this faded very, very rapidly. Right? There was an attempt. They produced a thing called the Declaration of Four and so on and so forth. It failed miserably. And these left social democratic organisations, or centrist organisations, very rapidly declined in most cases. Their membership tended to evaporate. What happened to it? And it went back to either the Social Democrats proper or to the Communist parties. Because, as I said, even the Comintern parties were shaken by Hitler, and because they were shaken, they began to take one or two half steps away from the whole lunacy of the third period, social fascism and so on, towards the idea that actually villains and scoundrels and vermin as these social democratic leaders are, and they still habitually use this sort of language, nevertheless we will offer them two fingers of friendship anyway, if not a hand, they began to move basically towards the United Front position, right, to resist fascism. In particular, in France, which is now the most important country in Europe. You see, not everywhere is equally important at any given time. In 1932, Trotsky had described Germany as the key to the international situation, and that was right, good, it was no longer. Germany's lost, Central Europe's lost. France is now, you know, the central thing in Europe. The French CP, which shifted, partly, not simply on orders from Moscow, by the way, but partly because it was a mass party, after all, its leaders were shaken. Not only by events in Germany and Austria and so on, by the fascist, what seemed to be the development of fascist, big fascist movement in France itself, shifted a bit towards the United Front. And these half-hearted shifts, which as I say, we now know, were proceeding in a sense almost independently of the Moscow Centre, received a decisive impetus when Stalin's foreign policy changed. Now, it may seem incredible, but it is the case, that until, not just until Hitler came to power, but until for some time afterwards, for at least 6 or 8 months afterwards, the Russian foreign policy was predicated on the following assumptions. There is indeed a danger of war. The danger of war has been exacerbated by the slump. The main enemies are France and Britain. They are the powers most likely to attack the USSR. The main ally or half ally or quarter ally which can be utilised against them is Germany. Right? And this, by the way, was not new. I mean, it had some roots in reality in the 20s. Never mind the thing. That was their stuff. However, it became obvious, even to the people in the Kremlin, that actually, after a while, Hitler in power makes a difference. German rearmament makes a difference. The denunciation of the Versailles Treaty, and in particular the restrictions on the German armed forces, does make a difference. So Russian foreign policy shifted towards the idea that, really, we need military alliances, if possible, with France, with Britain. And because the foreign policy shifted, and by this time, although the Comintern was never simply an instrument of Russian foreign policy, that's a gross oversimplification, also consists of a number of mass parties, and mass parties necessarily have roots in their own countries, and therefore are not simply, you know, puppets and reflections of something else. Nevertheless, the two things coincided. The fear of fascism at home and the shift of Russian foreign policy in favour of alliances in Britain and France, and so, in 1935 actually, the Popular Front policy was born. Back a little, back a short distance, back into 34, the problem of creating revolutionary forces out of the fragments and breakaways from the social democratic parties has produced no result at all. In fact, its main result of crop of polemics. If you read Trotsky's writings at this time, you'll find that article after article denounces centrism. In terms of practical results, zero. So what to do? Without the party, no prospect of revolution. Without revolution, a big movement. Real and immediate danger of fascism. A desperate expedient was resorted to. It was called the French Turn. And the idea was this. Look, we're still in 34. May 1934. Look, the Social Democrats are growing. That was a fact. New people are attracted to them. Just as the Communist parties are growing. Under the impact of the growth of fascism, the left is growing. In the Socialist parties, unlike the Communist Party, because their regime is less monolithic, less bureaucratic, and so on, it will be left-wing currents are crystallizing out. It will be possible to create out of these, out of a new generation, basically, out of the youth, the nucleus of new communist parties. Therefore, conclusion, enter the Socialist Party, the French Socialist Party, the British Labour Party. Actually, we'd argue for the ILP in Britain, a special case in the first instance, forget it. Even the American Socialist Party eventually, enter the Socialist Party. The thing became generalised. Well, now, let's see how this was envisaged. It was not envisaged as the sort of thing that militants and people like that do now. You know, that is to say, you go inside a social democratic party and you pretend, actually, you're an authentic party and you're really the authentic social democratic tradition, and it's the other lot who are not. On the contrary, it was argued that you've got to get in there, precipitate a hard, sharp, clear fight against the right and against the vacillating centre, in order, as Trotsky said, to rally the genuine revolutionary elements, the elements moving to a revolutionary position, split. The other lot will kick you out, actually. You probably won't have to take the initiative with a split. You fight hard, clear, no compromise, no disguising your politics. You're communist, you're in there, social democracy is counter-revolutionary, and so on. In these circumstances, you can whip off numbers of people. Now, you've got to understand the conditions of the time for that even to be, you know, appear remotely plausible. I've tried to explain them. The whole atmosphere of crisis, of fascism on the mark, of the world crisis ever deepening, economic crisis and so on and so forth. It made the thing look a little more realistic. Now jump to 35 again. The Popular Front is emerging, and we have the coincidence of these two things. The growth of both the Social Democratic parties and the Communist parties. Now the Communist parties adopting a new line, actually to the right of the Social Democrats. What is their line now? It comes to this. One. The main danger is fascism. Two, to fight fascism, we require the broadest possible alliance. Three, the broadest possible alliance, it was not put quite so crudely as this, but this is the effective content, includes, of course, the ruling classes of the British and French empires, which are the only serious military forces in Europe, apart from Hitler and, of course, ourselves, and with whom we want a military alliance. Therefore, four, the policy of the workers' parties must be changed in such a way that you do not frighten the French and British ruling classes, who, unfortunately, are capitalists and imperialists and so on and so forth, which means that you've actually got to drop the bit about being against capitalism, at least in the immediate, you know, you can talk about it in the long term, and you've got to drop the anti-imperialist bit, which until that time had been consistently pursued, even as the parties became Stalinized, right? For example, India. Britain, the key thing, by far and away the biggest British colony. India, with a vastly greater population than Britain, the British Communist Party, even in its, you know, the period of early Stalinization, fought consistently and honourably, and it was the only political force to do so, unconditional independence for India, unconditional support for the Indian national movement, for risings against the British and so on and so on. We can't have that anymore, though, because we actually want an alliance with the British government. And consequently, the whole Popular Front movement coincided with a popular revulsion against fascism and a real fear of fascism. You mustn't assume it's all manipulation, right? The fear was there. The argument, put as they put it, unite against fascism. Everyone against fascism. Broad alliance, which meant in Britain, it was applied in British terms to argue the Labour Party, the Liberal Party and the Communist Party must form an alliance, you see? In Britain, the Communist Party did not have the weight to make this a reality. In France, it did. The Communist Party, the French Radical Party, which was the main bourgeois democratic party in France at the time, you can call it the centre, centre-left and so on, the Socialist Party, did in fact form a popular front, did in fact come to power in 36. Ditto in Spain. Now then, under these circumstances, the workers' movement was both growing and moving to the right. Those two things are not incompatible. At the same time it was moving to the right. Militancy was reviving, yet at the same time the political direction was to the right. Great explosion in France in 36. Mass strikes, sort of preview of 68 and so on, but even so, in some ways, because of the different political circumstances of the time, much more threatening to the French ruling class. Indeed, Trotsky rashly predicted when the thing broke out, he wrote an article saying the French Revolution had begun. Now, that was an exaggeration, but it was not a grotesque exaggeration in the circumstances of the time. Look at Spain. In Spain, a Popular Front government was elected, there's a military fascist coup attempted against it, and that coup is met by a mass working class response, right? Mass working class resistance. The Spanish Civil War got underway. If it had been left to the bourgeois elements in the Popular Front, there would have been no Spanish Civil War, because they would have capitulated initially. You've always got to look not just at the result, but at the potential. You have this rising militancy, growth in the movement, but tragically, the authority of the leaderships being reinforced, and these leaderships being actually further and further rightward moving. Under these circumstances, back to the French term, the entry bit, the Trotskyists were doomed. They came out of the Social Democratic parties with rather smaller forces in many cases than they went in, sometimes a bit larger, but we're talking about little groups of dozens, or in the best of cases, a couple of hundred, 300 or 400 or so people. In the best of cases, that was what was left of the revolutionary movement. Now, two final points. First one, three. Or rather, two and a half. I'll give you the half first. I should have talked also about what was happening in Russia in this period. In fact, it's really Hamlet without the Prince of Denmark, in a sense, but I haven't really left myself adequate time to do so. So I'll merely say this. You see, the contrast between economic decay, mass unemployment, hopelessness, and so on, in the West. Read books like The Town That Was Murdered by Ellen Wilkinson. Books written in Britain by left reformists at the time, The contrast between that, the final crisis of capitalism has appeared, rotting away, and on the other hand, on the other side of the hill, where the grass is greener, there is no unemployment, comrades, the 5-year plans are underway, new steelworks in Magnitogorsk, progress all along the line, a backward country, peasant country is being transformed into the most progressive, democratic, etc., etc. country in the world, right? That's the burden of the propaganda. And again, you laugh at it now, and I suppose I'm inviting you to laugh at it by the way I put it. Nevertheless, at the time, you need to understand it had a very, very powerful appeal. There's a short name for that appeal. One word, religion, isn't it? You know what Marx said about religion? The hope of a hopeless world, the worse it is here, the more important it is to believe that, you know, there is a happy land not far beyond the circle of the sky, in this case, as the old hymn says, but actually not so far away and able to influence what happens in the world. That enormously strengthened the power of Stalin. Second point, the Trotskyists themselves were influenced inevitably by the experience which excluded them from effective participation in the class struggle. Look, what did their politics consist of? Not their fault, but circumstances. Their politics came to consist of criticising the policies of the Communist Party, the Labour Party, this policy, that policy, the other policy, and very little else. Not because they were, you know, by nature in the first instance at all, you know, sectarian clubbies. That's not true at all. That's not true at all. But if you live your whole life with a diet of criticising other people without ever having had the opportunity to organise anything yourself, even to make your own mistakes and so on, then a particular style of politics develops, and even more, after a time there is a selection of personalities, isn't there? You know? Small groups, mass movements, this psychological and other stuff is nonsense, right? But small groups, no, no, selection of personality types does occur when we're talking a few dozen, a few hundred people. Consequently, not only were the Trotskyists isolated, to some extent they have become, by 1938 or 9, in most cases, not in all, self-isolating also, unable to mesh in, you know, to, in spite of Trotsky's own immense experience, they were unable to mesh in with what opportunities did exist in the movement, and those opportunities were precious few. Because by 1938, the Spanish Revolution had been defeated, another fascist victory. The same year, spring, Hitler took Austria. The autumn of that year, he took the Sudetenland. The beginning of 39, he swallowed Czechoslovakia, then the Memelland. The Second World War was clearly about to begin. It's already obvious, you know, even to children, you know. By 1938, the war is coming, the fascist front on the upsurge everywhere. Therefore, rally round the Popular Front flag or something like this. Final point. In these desperately difficult circumstances, Trotsky evidently believed that the only thing he could leave, really, was the programme. By the programme is not meant, or was not meant then, a list of things, you know, we are for the nationalisation of the 200 great monopolies or what have you, but rather a statement of what he saw as being the essence of the communist tradition, if not for this generation, for the future one. And, being human, he did permit himself the belief that actually, out of the crisis of war, no questions coming, somehow or other, in spite of the total isolation of mass revolutionary parties, the total non-existence of mass revolutionary parties, and the near total isolation of the Trotskyists, somehow or other, there would be another 1916, another 1917, another 1918 and 1919, and this time we would win. So an element of mysticism had entered into the tradition. But, remember, comrades, had that tradition not been fought for, we would not exist today in our present form or anything like it. We would be at an incomparably lower level of struggle. I have told the tale of defeat after defeat after defeat. That tale is the reality. It is the truth. We emerge from a tradition forged in defeat. But that tradition forged in defeat is an essential element in the building of an instrument which can create ultimately the series of victories.